presents to you Dr. Carol Slim.
So, let's start all over. Good evening.
Good evening.
It's a pleasure to be here. This is my first time to visit Montana. And to get here, I flew from Nashville to Newark to Denver and finally to Billings. People are hard to find. But I'm here now. And I like to play that video because I want people to get a sense of who they're in the room with. Most university professors don't have a background like mine. And when I look at my story, it's hard for me not to accept and acknowledge that I come from, not only do I come from a very different place, but it surely shapes my worldview and the way I have responded to many of the things that I see in academia. And I grew up in the mid-60s. I was born in 1954. That makes me 63 for those who want to do the math. And even though, you know, as I was growing up, I was able to watch on TV the Civil Rights Movement, and I started off in segregated schools. Throughout all that time, I always believed in America. And I believed I lived in the greatest country in the world. And I felt like, you know, if I worked hard, I can overcome the circumstances of my birth. And maybe that makes me a little bit different because somehow I was not influenced in a way by everything that was taking place. I was not influenced so that I never felt that I couldn't control some parts of my life. But as the video shows, I'm married at 16, and the family that I was in, it was very dysfunctional by any definition. There were 12 of us, and of the 12, I was the one that got out. And when you think about that, and I know that in a room this size that there are other people with a similar story, but being the only one that gets out, sometimes, you know, you have a lot of guilt because you almost like, why me? And before I became a Christian, it was very troubling to me because I didn't think it was fair that I got out and the rest of them didn't. And so I spent, you know, a lot of my early 20s, you know, in therapy, you know, trying to deal with the fact that I got out of that situation and I didn't really understand it. Now, you know, as a, I would say born again Christian, I'm, you know, the more intellectual way to say that is, I guess, you know, conversion, or there are other ways to say it, but I believe born again captures who I am and my experience. I look back at my life and I feel, you know, very favored by God, very chosen. I feel that I have a responsibility, you know, to not just to my family, but to the world, to speak the truth that I believe has been revealed to me as it's been revealed. And I know that you all, the people in this room, there may be a few people that don't care deeply about America, but I would imagine that 95% of you do. And our nation is definitely at a crossroads, and you can see it with the moral, the economic, and the spiritual decline. And even though for many of us, we feel that with the election of President Trump, there may be a little bit of a reprieve, you can see by all the forces that are taking place, the anarchy, the resistance, and just the very fact that he's working with Congress of people that are very much entrenched in a system that has its own self-interest. And so that system is seeking to maintain itself in such a way that it's not really clear how much, you know, with the best of intentions, the president would be successful. And I supported Mr. Trump, and now President Trump, not at the beginning, but I came on board at some point, and I see his election as no less than a miracle, given all the forces that were arrayed against him. And so I would like to see him be successful, but for him to be successful, you know, it's going to take we the people. And one of the books that I published in 2009. It's called Be the People, A Call to Reclaim America's Faith and Promise. And this was published in 2011. I started working on it in 2009. And it was a call to the we the people, us, the we the people, to stand up and be the people who would reclaim our nation. And the reason I wrote that book is I was looking at everything that was taking place in our country by summer of 2009, and I was looking at the data. You know, still, an overwhelming majority of people profess to be Christians, yet if you look at our nation and the path that we've chosen, and even I will get to the universities, the chaos that we see in various places, I was puzzled that how could a nation where the majority of people profess to be Christian be so dysfunctional, I mean, I'm calling it dysfunctional, but be so ungodly moving in that direction. And so I concluded that most people probably did not know the tenets of their religion. And for them, being a Christian was, you know, they were cultural Christians. They were born in a nation that was predominantly Christian. And just like children that are born into families that may be deeply religious, so, you know, they're born into a Baptist, a Catholic, Episcopalian, Presbyterian. They're born into the family, but it may not have any type of real influence over them. And so I decided that I would write a book that would look at some of the issues affecting Americans, and it would give the social science data as well as the biblical worldview. And I think that for some people, the biblical worldview is what is missing. And once they get that, you know, they're free to reject it. And I think in a lot of cases, we have within our political parties, we have people that were born either into families that were traditionally Democratic or traditionally Republican, but that person's heart is not really with, you know, they may call themselves a Republican, or may call themselves a Democrat, but when you look at what they believe and their value system and the party platforms, they really don't line up very well. And so what some of them do is stay in that political party and they try to change it into whatever they want it to be. And so for whatever reason, you know, things are not lining up the way you would think that they would line up, not in a neat, orderly fashion. And when it comes to political parties, I've long felt that, you know, those situations where people are in one political party but their heart is in the other political party, that the best thing we can help do for those people is to help them transition. That's a joke. But right now we're in this situation where we can take nothing for granted that relates to our Constitution. We can't take it for granted that, you know, the majority of Americans have read it, and certainly not our young people. We know that freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of association, that those things are not things that we can take for granted any longer. And at public universities, there's more legally, you know, you're in a better position to demand and get enforcement of those First Amendment rights because of the fact that it's a public institution, but private institutions can have their own rules, their own values. They're not bound by the First Amendment. And so a lot is going on. And the changes in our society has caused me, when I was first tenured, I taught at Princeton for 10 years, I was tenured there, I was a congressional scholar, and then later I started doing current public policy issues and became interested in other things. And I have watched universities change. I've been a faculty member now at either Princeton or Vanderbilt for 27 years, and I got my education late. You know, from the bachelor's degree, I started at a community college, born from that community college through other universities. I've seen and I've heard a lot, and universities, I would say, have changed dramatically in the last, I would even say the last 3 to 5 years in ways that I never anticipated. You could see it coming, but I never thought it would reach the point that it has today. And I recently made a decision that I would take early retirement from my university, and that had to do with the fact that the changes that were taking place, but also my sense and a need, you know, to take a message that I believe that I have to a wider audience. And I don't think most of you all really truly realize what's happening on the campuses and how it seeped down into secondary schools. And you may have your child in a public school or a private school, unless that child is being homeschooled, you know, with a Christian curriculum, or that child is in a classical Christian school, they're being exposed to things that you probably would find shocking, or they'll be exposed to teachers that are there, you know, and in some cases highly motivated to influence your child and steer your child towards a secular worldview, and that has become their mission. With the culture of Marxism and the universities, cultural Marxism is a term that a lot of people may not have heard of, and I will explain it in a little bit, but all of us have heard of the nonsense that's taking place on college and university campuses. There you find that common sense has been replaced by political correctness, microaggressions, and trigger warnings. And the young people know what I'm talking about, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, with political correctness, it's another form of cultural Marxism. It seeks to protect oppressed minorities from language or ideas that they might find offensive. The problem is that those ideas and the language, it keeps changing. And so the list of what might be offensive is endless. But it creates jobs for people that want to protect them, that want to educate the rest of us and protect them from anything that they might find offensive. And political correctness has reached the point now that for professors, it's very difficult to teach at a university if you sort of subscribe to the norms, because the students are primed to be overly sensitive. They're primed to look for microaggressions. And the microaggressions, that's a perceived slight. You get it? A perceived slight. It's not a person overtly engaged in some type of demeaning talk or racism. It could be something very simple, such as a professor that might ask a student that speaks with an accent, or maybe a racial or ethnic minority, where are you from? That could be a microaggression. Telling a girl that her dress is pretty, I mean, that could be a huge microaggression. But a young man opening a door for a young lady could be a microaggression. And so it's things that they're perceived slights that you never know when you're gonna commit one of these. And for professors that are teaching, you know, if you're teaching a particular subject, many schools would expect you to give trigger warnings. And so a trigger warning, had I come in here to give one, I would have informed the audience that I might say something that would offend you if you are overly sensitive in a particular area. But it's like a warning that you may experience something that will cause you some discomfort. And so since I didn't start off with that, I will give it now. Listening to me tonight may give you some discomfort, because I may expose you to some ideas that may seem foreign to you and may create difficulty in your being able to sleep tonight. And universities have invested millions of dollars into sensitivity training and the safe spaces. And things have become ludicrous in so many ways, because we have black students at some colleges, some predominantly white colleges, that are demanding separate classes. And in some schools, at least one school, they've been granted that. They want separate dorms. They're asking for segregation And when you think about the civil rights movement and how hard people fought for integration, to think that we would be going backwards. We would be going backwards and university administrators would be standing by and in many cases defending it and endorsing it. But universities have had to invest heavily into counseling services for students, as well as the dean of students' office. That administrative structure has increased even more. And at some universities, the students get regular emails, telling them, for example, after the election, there were a spate of emails to students telling them that they may be traumatized by the election results. And so there were all these counseling services. In some cases, there were Play-Doh and Furby dolls and everything that might be needed to make people feel better. And that was part of what the universities are doing. And they do it all the time. And I myself, as you might have figured out by now, I've run afoul of the political correctness enforcers. And the major offense that I did that totally caught me off guard, it literally blindsided me, was that in January 2015, I wrote an opinion piece in the local newspaper that criticized Islam. And I write opinion pieces a lot, or at least I did up until that time. No, it actually silenced me for a while. I was literally traumatized. I needed a safe space. And unfortunately, I was on sabbatical, and so I, to some extent, I had one. But it led to the Muslim students complaining, other students joining in. There was a protest, and I was denounced for my bigotry and my hatred, and I was harassed, and it was something that I did not expect to happen. And that, to me, that was like evidence of a major change within academia, because I had not personally witnessed a faculty member having that happen to them after they had written something in a local newspaper. And so, that was a new level, and apparently an email went out to students telling them that they needed counseling because of the ideas expressed in my opinion piece, that they could get these counseling services. And it was like a whole new world seeing my name, in the paper, because this got national attention. Very, very hurtful, because I've always loved students, but also what was awful at the time actually was positive in a sense. It sort of boosted my standing in the world, because a lot of people came to my defense, a lot of people prayed for me, and my Facebook fans jumped 5,000 almost overnight. I think 35,000 Facebook fans now, and I was stuck before that happened. And I've had numerous things happen that relates to this. And so, like when I'm talking about cultural Marxism and political correctness, is because I've sort of been, in the thick of all of this. I've had the other experience of, as the same year, the November of 2015, I had a student message me on Facebook to tell me that he didn't like what I was posting on Facebook, and that if I made another post that offended, he had a long list of groups, and I can't remember all the groups, that if I posted anything that offended any of those groups, that he was going to have me fired. And me, not to let a challenge go by, as soon as I finished reading his post, his message, I immediately searched for an article that I thought would offend all of those groups, and I posted And the young man, true to his word, he started a petition to have me, the petition changed like 5 times, but first it was to have me fired. And they kept, figuring out, okay, she's tenured, we can't get her fired, not easily anyway. And so then it kept changing, and it finally, the final version was to force me to undergo mandatory sensitivity training. Now, can you imagine this at the time? I'm a 62-year-old woman who's been teaching in academia, you know, at that time, for 26 years, and they want to force me to go through sensitivity training. And I responded on Facebook by saying that only an idiot would propose that. And the young man outed himself and said, I'm the idiot who proposed it. what's interesting about that is that I received a phone call, and it was the day before I was to film Hillary's America, and I was in Texas, and it was a Sunday, and the caller left a message, this is the dean, I'm trying to reach you. And I didn't believe any dean would be calling me on a Sunday, but it was a dean, and she was giving me a heads up. And I didn't think much of it. I didn't think that it was serious. And she didn't lead me to believe that it was going to be a big deal, because we knew that I certainly wasn't going to get fired over it, because I hadn't done anything. But the petition said that I shouldn't call myself a professor because I made Vanderbilt look bad. Now, I'm not making Vanderbilt look bad tonight, but that was one of the things. And the other was that because I was a Christian, I might discriminate against old school groups, and I might. And there was no student that had ever taken a class with me that had ever filed a complaint, nor were any of those students part of this petition. It was students, some of them from other campuses. Rutgers, the University of Massachusetts, other campuses that were behind it. And I later found out that they were behind, some of the students were behind efforts to oust four other conservative professors. So I was targeted. Then the last thing was they said I didn't like Muslims, and for all those reasons I needed to be forced to undergo sensitivity training. And I think that the problem with the sensitivity training is that it probably backfires. I don't know, maybe with young people that are freshmen and as soon as they get to campus, they're sort of immersed in the sensitivity training. And a lot of it is about white privilege and the need, you know, whites to check their privilege at the door. And I'm sure, you know, that there are some whites that are privileged, just like there's some blacks that are privileged. And I would say now that I'm privileged. I mean, I may have started at the bottom, but I would consider myself privileged now. But the sensitivity training, the way it's done in a way that I think it probably backfires. And this rise of the alt-right, you know, of people like this Milo character, and they're saying that there are more young whites that are interested, you know, in white nationalism and white rights. I think it's very much affected by things that are taking place on college campuses. And there's a book that I don't have here tonight that I wrote that was published in 2002 called The New White Nationalism. It's a challenged integration. And back then I noticed, you know, that there were a new brand of leader within the white rights, you could call it white supremacy, but it was shifting. It was not just old-fashioned white supremacy when I wrote the book. That's why I called it the new white nationalism. But within that group, there were people that were using social science data, FBI statistics, all kinds of data to argue, to argue against minorities. They were using data rather than using racial epithets or even talking about white supremacy. In fact, some of those leaders were not even, they didn't make the arguments of white supremacy. They might would argue that Asians were superior to whites, but they used multiculturalism in the language of political identity to argue that whites needed to organize, that whites needed to recognize that they had an interest. And they pointed out racial double standards. And I read the arguments that they were making, and I commissioned interviews of 10 leaders that were leaders of the white nationalism at that time. Some of them were very extreme people, like William Pierce, who wrote the Turner Diaries, David Duke, Matthew Hale, Word Church of the Creator. They were on the extreme end, But there were others like Michael Levin, Michael Hart, they're Jewish PhDs. Michael Hart, I think, teaches philosophy at one of the CUNY colleges. And the other, Michael Levin teaches at a college. Michael Hart, I think, taught at a community college. But the people that I was most interested in, Jared Taylor, who started American Renaissance, they were not fitting the stereotype, the traditional stereotype. And the stereotype that I was seeing at the time were the people with the beer guts, the missing teeth, you know, the ones that when you see them on TV, you laugh because you knew that they couldn't do anything, that they were just losers. They were a bunch of losers. That's how they looked. And yet what I was seeing was that there were some issues that the American public cared about at the time that were not being addressed by mainstream politicians. And those issues included the liberal immigration policies, concerns about racial preferences, concerns about minority crime, globalization, loss of jobs. And I saw at the time how the internet was being used to empower those people. And I argued for us to listen to what they were saying, you know, to bring them and to let them debate them. Don't just decide that, you know, they're so bad that we don't want to hear what they have to say. And when I'm talking about listening to them, I'm talking about the ones that were more intellectual, that were making a case about racial double standards, or were saying that discrimination was taking place against whites, or whatever they were saying, the ones that were more intellectual. I thought people needed to know that this was the face of the threat. It's not, you know, the KKK or the neo-Nazis, because the KKK is almost non-existent. Neo-Nazis, you know, a tiny fraction of the population, that all of this has shifted and changed form. So my book was really a warning about what has become the alt-right. And to me, the alt-right is just a rebranded white nationalism. And it has used that language of identity politics and multiculturalism that can trace its roots back to cultural Marxism. On the university campuses, with the things that are taking place with the political correctness, and I have a few things that I wanted to read that have taken place at some campuses. The most recent thing is this is a campus newspaper, St. Louis University, Boston investigation after a student filed a biased report over an editorial in the Catholic University student newspaper that discussed societal views towards deviant sexual orientations. And the title of it was Gender and Sexual Identification, Right and Wrong. It was retracted a few days after it was published, but the author's question, how society views individuals holding unusual attractions, such as zoophilia, I think I pronounced it right, attraction to animals, bestiality, sexual relationships with animals, and pedophilia. And so they were questioning how society views these. The reaction was almost immediate, and the article was retracted, but the people that all these concessions were granted in, as part of the retraction. Let's see if I can find it. Well, let me just read a little bit of the retraction. The University News Editorial Board has decided to retract our February 16 editorial entitled Gender and Sexual Identification, Right and Wrong. We would like to offer our sincere apologies to anyone who was hurt by the offensive nature of the piece. The editorial was intended to be an exploration of the ways in which a society's views of different behaviors and identities can change over time. In our initial discussion of the topic, we talked about how certain ideas that were once viewed as deviant or morally wrong have grown to be accepted over time. We hypothesized about how the process could conceivably continue into the future with ideas that we in the present might find unacceptable or even abhorrent, and discuss the merits by which society uses to judge these behaviors. And then it goes on and on and on
and apologizes. And the reaction to the piece has been to demand a restorative justice process, staff resignations, diversity training, and the creation of a queer column. And so it's not clear, you know, whether or not the people that wrote the original article, if they're going to be able to keep their jobs. But that was one that took place at a Catholic university. But even a white person wearing their hair in braids, or someone, you know, that says, I love Mexican food, if they're not Mexican, all of these things can be considered offensive and resulting in all sorts of apologies. Schools or universities that might want to have, you know, Mexican food one night, and I'm not making this up, this has happened, where they have been challenged, and people have said that they have been injured by things that have taken place. And there have been even arguments that ski slopes, you all know something about ski slopes, right? That somehow that's racist, and but there's an endless number of things to be offended about. And you wonder, you know, how did this happen? Did it happen overnight? And I would say, no, it didn't happen overnight. You know, it was coming. But when I was in college, and I was in college in the 80s getting my bachelor's degree, there were Marxist professors, and we talked about postmodernism and critical race theory and deconstructionism, but it had not taken over the universities. Now, some of that's not talked about as much, but it's already been implemented. It's not necessary now for a professor to say, I'm a Marxist professor, or I believe these things, because the administrators, and many times the college presidents, they're either, you know, steeped in this stuff, or they're afraid to speak out. And so the political left has a critical mass. And I think that I can tell you how it happened, and it happened gradually. If you go back I'm going to talk about Solonitsky in a minute, but before that, I have to tell you that the cultural Marxism is an outgrowth of classical Marxism, and most of you all probably would know about classical Marxism, the Communist Manifesto, and, you know, the theory that Karl Marx advanced in 1848 about how the proletariat would rise up and overthrow, you know, the capitalists. And they would gradually, you know, these changes would take place, and you would create a utopian society, and there would not be any need, you know, for social classes, that the state, as we understand the state, the government, all of that would wither away. The classical economic Marxism, it failed in so many ways. It didn't happen the way Karl Marx and his followers thought it would happen. In fact, when Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, and around the time he died, it seemed as if it was a failure. But by the 20th century, that's when it really took off with students of his. And the cultural Marxism came about through followers of Marx who believed that the reason that the economic Marxism failed was that the people were not ready for it, that the only way that you could have a successful revolution would be to change the hearts and minds of the people. And so then the strategy shifted. And so that's how you started getting the roots in the 1920s of what eventually was able to get a critical mass and become what we have today. And with the cultural Marxism, the Marxists that were in Germany in the 1930s, they came, they fled Germany. They came to the United States and set up at Columbia University. and from Columbia University, you know, students, various students, people came through. It was able to spread gradually throughout American universities. So by the 1960s, you had people that were steeped in Marxism in the colleges and universities, but you also had an era of the 1950s where there was a lot of prosperity, where people were able to send their children to colleges. And so you had a wealthy group of people that were prosperous, they were in colleges, and they were being taught the Marxism. And you can remember that it seemed like the 1960s that for many of us, the world turned upside down. Some people will pinpoint 1963 as being the major turning point. I would say 1962 would be part of that because that was when prayer was taken out of school. 1963 was when Bible reading, you know, was taken out of school. And so a lot of changes, but then you started having, the feminist movement, the bra burning, 1968, the riots at the Democratic Convention, and some of the anarchy that you see taking place today. I mean, it was taking place in the 1960s and it was even more violent. And we don't know whether or not what we see today, if that's going to become more violent as Mr. Trump proceeds with his agenda. It's not clear where all of this is going to go. And with the cultural Marxists, they believe that to bring about the changes of that they believe would be best for the world and best for society, you have to destroy Western culture and Western civilization. And so all of this stuff is geared at destroying the institutions that many Americans, that are the bedrock of America. Whether you're talking about the family, the schools, you know, using the public schools to transmit their values. I mean, that was something that was done and is being done. And I would say that's being done quite successfully. And also the attack on the morals of the children and the family. And you saw in the 1960s, you know, the free sex movement. There was so much that was taking place that was shocking. It was shocking, you know, to the parents and to the older generation that was watching it. And the rebels of the 1960s, they were very successful, just like the ones today, at turning off average Americans. Because what they were doing was so repugnant to the values that most people held back then. And so then in comes Saul Alinsky, who watched what was taking place during the Democratic Convention. And he wrote his book, Rules for Radicals. And it was a rewrite of a book he had written, you know, in the 1940s, but Rules for Radicals, published in the 1970s, and he pretty much advised the radicals to, you know, cut your hair, put on a suit, go inside the system and change the system. And so many of those people were taught how to infiltrate institutions, how to manipulate and use deception. And that was very successful because what you have today is that many of those radicals who wanted to overthrow the nation in the 1960s, they are running the institutions now. And so they have more power than anyone ever imagined that they could have. And that is part of what's taking place today. And as soon as they got their critical mass, I mean, immediately they started shutting down the free speech of other people. And that was part of the tactic, too, is to be tolerant of everything that they do, but intolerant of anyone that opposes their agenda. And what I did not anticipate was that at the colleges and universities that it would reach the point where I would argue that most universities are no longer marketplaces of ideas where you have people with opposing views and they debate, or you have forums where you bring in people that are equally matched that can debate issues. You see not much of that taking place on college campuses and universities. You might have a Dinesh D'Souza, and Charles Murray was at Vanderbilt a few days ago, and you may remember what happened when he was at Berkeley and at Middlebury. How he was protested, he was not allowed to speak. And at Vanderbilt, he was sort of brought in almost undercover. It was not advertised. It was by invitation only. And there was security there. We had wristbands. And so he was able to speak to the people who were invited to be there. But in today's college campuses, the political left has pretty much succeeded in creating an environment where if you're conservative, it's very difficult to teach at those institutions or to bring in speakers that can have access to the students, where you can be able to have a lecture where the faculty member is not shouted down. And it's happened, you know, again and again that people get invited to give commencement addresses, and if they do get invited, they get disinvited very quickly. And so the political left at the universities, they're engaging in a very overt form of oppression. And I think that the oppression, it takes many forms. I think there is oppression against certain groups of people, in particular, healthy white males. And I know I'm not supposed to say that, and no one's supposed to notice, but it's taking place.
Absolutely.
It is taking place. And as a mother and a grandmother, you know, I think about my own children, and I can have empathy, and I don't think it's fair. And I'm wondering why so many parents tolerate what's taking place. Because as long as you're willing to pay those big bucks and send your child to institutions where this is going on, then you're supporting the system. And there's another thing, is that there are very few conservative faculty members on most of those campuses. And on some of those campuses, the Christians that are conservative, they've either been pushed off campus or they've been pushed underground. And so you send your child to a place where they're going to be mocked and they're going to be shamed because they're Christian. And so you actually, you know, you may want your child to go to Harvard or to Yale or to some elite school. And I would say that of the Ivy schools, Princeton is probably the best one because they do have a strong Christian conservative component there. But you're paying your money to send your child somewhere that if their faith is not destroyed by the time they get out of high school, very few will survive the college education because, you know, everyone wants to be liked, and most people do, or they want to be accepted. And on those college campuses, the professors, they have so many ways to, you know, to shame students. And that's the environment. And I think that environment will continue as long as parents are willing, you know, to pay the money to send their children there, and as long as conservatives on those campuses are reluctant to speak up. And when you do speak up, it is a great risk. Because if you're in a class as a student, you know, you want to get your grade, it's a lot easier to go along. But what I don't understand is why conservative students and Christian students don't band together and start demanding the hiring of conservative faculty, demanding their rights, because they're paying the same tuition dollars as everyone is. And so why shouldn't they have the same rights? And I think that if more students were willing, you know, to stand up and start organizing and using some of those Saul Alinsky strategies. A few years ago, I started teaching a course on political culture, and the purpose of teaching that course was to show the students how the communist ideology had influenced American political society, you know, America's political society. Because I think a lot of students and a lot of people think that what is taking place is just the natural progression of time, that as we grew older, we became wiser, and that this is just natural and normal. They're really shocked to learn that it's part of an agenda that goes all the way back, you know, to the 1920s. And one of the books that I have my students read, I have them read the Communist Manifesto, and I have them read Cleon Skousen's The Naked Communist, as well as Saul Alinsky and some other things. And the reason I have them read Cleon Skousen is that he had a book that was published in the late 1950s, and in that book, near his appendix, he had labeled 45 current communist goals. And those goals were read into the congressional record in 1963, and they were debated in Congress and on the Senate floor. And I'm going to read you some of those then-current communist goals. And I think most people are shocked, and I'm going to skip down to start at goal number 15. Capture one or both of the political parties in the United States. I would argue they've captured one and they're making inroads on the other. Use technical decisions of the courts to weaken basic American institutions by claiming the activities violate civil rights. You think about the civil rights movement, how with the black civil rights movement, how many other groups have piggybacked on that to press for their own rights? And so that's part of that was part of the communist goals. To do that, to weaken the American institutions. Get control of the schools. Use them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda. Soften the curriculum. Get control of teachers' associations. Put the party line in textbooks. Goal 18, gain control of all student newspapers. I think that's happened at most institutions. Use student riots to foment public protests against programs or organizations which are under communist attack. Infiltrate the press. Get control of book review assignments, editorial writing, policy-making positions. Gain control of key positions in radio, TV, and motion pictures. Continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. And then it says here, an American communist cell was told to eliminate all good sculpture from parks and buildings. Substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. Control art critics and directors of art museums. Eliminate all laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech and free press. Break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, and TV. Again, this was 1958, I believe, Leon Skelton put this in his book. Present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Infiltrate the churches and replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible. Emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a religious crutch. 28, eliminate prayer or any phrase of religious expression in the schools on the ground that it violates the principle of separation of church and state. Discredit the American Constitution by calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step. Discredit the founding fathers. Belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teaching of American history on the ground that it was only a minor part of the big picture. I'm skipping down. Discredit and eventually dismantle the FBI. I think, you know, we did a pretty good job of that last year. Infiltrate and gain control of more unions. Infiltrate and gain control of big business. Transfer some of the powers of arrest from the police to social agencies. Treat all behavior problems as psychiatric disorders. Discredit the family as an institution. You see where this is going.
Yep.
They have accomplished almost all of their goals. And so, I mean, they have. And most people don't know about it. And the way the political left silences people is by calling them conspiracy theorists or by calling them nativists or bigots or any kinds of names, any kind of epithets. And that's enough to keep a lot of us silent. And I think that that is the greatest weapon that they have against us, and for some reason, too many of us allow that to be effective means of control. We don't want to be called names. We don't want to be called stupid. And so the political left knows, you know, that they can ridicule people. You know, you are Bertha or whatever name that they want to call, and it has effectively silenced the American people. It has neutered people, and they have not been willing to stand up for that Constitution. They've not been willing to stand up for their rights. And as a consequence, we have the society that we do. And, you know, what are we going to do about it? And I think the most important thing that we can do about it is to realize that knowledge is power. And for those of you who are homeschooling your children, I know that you're teaching them about the Constitution and about the civic values and norms. but they also need to know this information as well. And I am encouraged by the young people that I meet, because many of them want to live in a society, you know, where you have, you know, families with mothers and fathers, and where there is law and order, not lawlessness. And we see that in recent years, that the lawlessness has just totally gripped the country. We don't enforce our laws in America. And one of the strengths of America was we were a nation of laws, and so as a nation of laws, we had a system in place. We have a system in place where if we don't like the laws on the books, that we know how to change our laws. But we have the lawlessness, and we're moving in a direction that, you know, that the system will implode. It will cave in unless we make changes. And we can see the things that have been destructive with with the illegal immigration, our compassion, because we are compassionate people. The money that Americans give to other countries through missions and through various organizations. You know, Americans are generous people, but when it comes to just flooding the country, you know, with people from other countries, there's no way in the world that you could take everyone who wanted to come to America. And if you did, it would not solve the problems of poverty. And back in the 1960s, 1970s, we talked about the brain drain. We talked about we wanted to bring people here to educate them so that they could go back to their countries and make a difference. We don't care about that anymore. We're not trying to send people back to their countries to make a difference. And so we are allowing America, in many ways, to be brought down. And for the people that want to destroy America, that they don't like the fact that there was a country, you know, that was more prosperous than other nations of the world, they have used the best of our intentions against us. And the way back is, it includes returning to our constitutional norms and being willing to fight for our Constitution. And it includes also, you know, just thinking about the founders, thinking about the Declaration of Independence. And you think about the Constitution, and America has not been a perfect country. We can think about all the flaws. One thing about America is that whenever there were things that were wrong, there were always people. There were the abolitionists. There were always people that were seeking to bring about change. And Americans as a whole, they've tried to be better. They've tried to do things differently. And I think that if we allow our nation to be destroyed, then, you know, I kind of want to say we deserve what we get if we allow our nation to be destroyed. And so, I mean, that's one take of it. As a Christian, I have to say that I don't think that there's a man-made solution for the problems that we have. And so, you know, with the best of intentions, we're not going to solve the world's problems. Jesus said the poor would always be with us, and we need to recognize that that's the case. There's no perfect solution. There will always be some people naturally that will be smarter, that will, you know, will be prettier, that will have more money. I mean, that's the natural state of things. And we just have to make a decision if we love America, if we care enough about things to be able to fight for what we have. And for the young people, I mean, you really have to ponder. You really have to look at what's taking place in the colleges, the universities, the secondary schools, and realize that a lot of what you are getting is propaganda. And this book, Abduction, How Liberalism Steals the Hearts and Minds of Our Children, I think that most parents don't have a clue about what's taking place in our college, in our secondary schools. And it starts at starts at kindergarten, that there are some curriculums that are designed to teach sex education to five-year-olds. And it just escalates. And so this book talks about what they have gotten into the public schools. And you know, when most of us were growing up, your first best friend was someone of your same gender. You know, like little girls had little girls as friends. Usually their first close friend, and little boys hung out with boys. With this curriculum that they have, it seems to be designed to cause children to question, you know, question themselves in ways that most of us never had to do that. We never wondered if we were going to marry our best friend or if we loved our best friend, what that meant. And so that's still in part of our children's childhood. but that has taken place. And we also find that there are laws on the books that are really not protecting children, such as California's child prostitution law. It's framed as if it's there to help children. It's framed as if, and under this law, no one under the age of 18 can be charged with prostitution. And so that makes it much more difficult for the police to get a child off the street. It makes it much more difficult for them to require someone to testify because the crime didn't take place. It's a law that's designed for pimps and for pedophiles and for anyone that wants to exploit children. And we see again and again and again that there are laws and things that are in place that are not protecting our children, that in many ways that our children are being used for the sexual gratification of adults. And all of that goes back to, again, to the cultural Marxism, the desire to destroy the family, destroy the children, destroy the morals, and eventually destroy the nation. Thank you.
Carol is going to talk more about the book.